Bite into a stacked sandwich made with Hero Bread. And the only thing you'll think is, delicious. You won't think it has up to 19 grams protein, 11 to 32 grams of fiber, or just 0 to 5 grams net carbs. But it does. Hero Bread. No compromises, just loaves, buns, tortillas, bagels, and noodles packed with flavor. Right now, get 10% off at hero.co with code IHEART. That's hero.co, code IHEART. All figures per serving of Hero Bread. See nutrition facts on hero.co.
But I guess just to set the gravity of the situation, I used to have a nightmare, the same nightmare every night, over that situation. The sights, the sounds, the smells, the pain. And I've had night terrors. I was placed in therapeutic counseling when I was really, really young. It was a stipulation of my adoption. And I was actually clinically diagnosed with PTSD at 8 years old, and medicated. And, you know, it seems like all the counselors just wanted to give me medications to try to keep me calm. They never really tried to address the issue.
Before we dive in, just a quick favor. If you're enjoying what we're doing at Angels Among Us, please take a second to rate and review the show. And if something in today's episode touches your heart, please share it with a friend. Welcome to Angels Among Us, the podcast where we share real stories of angelic encounters. Each episode, you'll hear firsthand accounts of divine protection, guidance, and miraculous interventions that remind us we're never truly alone. Whether through a whisper of comfort, an unseen hand of protection, or an unmistakable presence, angels are closer than we think. Join us as we explore these powerful experiences of angels, both seen and unseen. Hello, hello. Welcome back to another episode of Angels Among Us. Brent and Michaela here as your hosts. We are joined from Arkansas, Hannah and Tracy. We are excited. I first came across Tracy. Well, they have a shared social media account, but I first came across them. It's been, I don't know, at least a few weeks now. And Tracy and I spoke on the phone. He's awesome. He's an inspiration. And you'll hear it's only because of Hannah. So we're thankful that you're both here with us. We'll go ahead and turn it over to you. You can give a little bit more of an introduction and get going on what you have for everybody today.
Yeah. First and foremost, thank you so much for just reaching out and wanting to have us on your show. It's truly an honor and a blessing just to be able to share our story and our testimony and really highlight the grace of God. So my name is Tracy. This is my wonderful wife, Hannah.
Hello.
We've been together now for, is this 12 years? Married for eight or nine.
Yeah, something
yeah.
like that.
I don't know. We were married in 2017.
This year will be nine.
Yeah, nine.
Awesome.
So we started sharing my story on social media, our stories. And honestly, the very first time we shared was a trend called a trauma candy salad. And we just thought maybe somebody would get a good laugh out of this. And it exploded. And then we started learning that through the story that I shared, we found a lot of people that could relate, which in itself is kind of heartbreaking to know that so many people struggled through so many things. But it was nice to know that all of them found peace, and not all of them, but most of them found peace in faith or people that have also been through hard circumstances. So do you want to say anything on your introduction?
You pretty much covered it.
Okay.
Yeah, we started off just kind of having fun. I thought I was starting a TikTok account, you know, for fun. And then my husband kind of hijacked it and everyone liked him more than me. So we just made it a joint account, I guess.
Yeah,
it's the mustache.
But we've had a lot of fun doing it. But yeah, it started with the trauma candy salad. Yeah. And I don't know.
Yeah, so I guess we just kind of jump right off into it. I come from... I don't even know if a broken family is what you would call it. I was born in prison because my biological parents took the life of my older brother when he was a 5 month old. And since that happened, when I was born, I was immediately placed into foster care. As the court case progressed, my biological dad took a plea bargain. He took a second-degree murder, and my biological mom took another plea bargain, and she was sentenced with endangering the welfare of a minor, and she only served 18 months in prison. I never got a good answer on who did what, and I was able to talk to both of my parents as adults, and they each, you know, just point the blame finger at each other. We actually got a lot of documents this last year about the medical examiner's report and autopsy reports. And it was a joint effort. I mean, the trauma that my brother sustained was massive. But I was court ordered to go visit my biological mom when she was still in prison. And of course, there was like a year and a half that the court, they had to do the trial. So I was, almost 4 years old the last time that I had to go visit her in prison. And I can vividly remember, you know, workers coming to the house to take me to go see Ashley. And it was a fight every time because I never wanted to see her. My bio mom's name is Ashley. If you hear me refer to her as Ashley, it's because I don't want to give her credit as, you know, mom. The last day that I had to visit Ashley, I didn't know that it was going to be my last time I ever see her in prison because she was being released, but I didn't want to hug her whenever we went to leave, and it made her really mad. And although it was unsupervised visits in the prison system, there were still guards, you know, everywhere. It's not like they just left me alone with her. So she couldn't like hit me, per se, but I remember that day she spit in my face and stormed off, because she was mad. When she got out of prison, she moved in with her mother, which is my granny, who was probably one of the first angels, I guess, in my life. That woman loved me and it was very obvious. And the house that she lived in actually is about 16 minutes from where we're sitting right now. The house is still up. It's still in town. When I had to visit Ashley, they were unsupervised visits, which I will never understand because of the circumstances leading up to it. Even if she only was charged with endangering the welfare of a minor, why would you, as a court legal system, allow, you know, children to go back to the home? But just to keep it brief, the abuse progressively got worse. It started off as emotional and then it quickly became physical. She got a boyfriend, and it became physical and sexual. And then there was a situation, the last time that I had to see my mom, where my mom and her boyfriend did something that was bad enough to where the Arkansas State Police got involved and investigated the case. I'll just keep it kind of vague. It was a form of physical mutilation. And state police got involved and they finally were able to terminate rights to my mom. Arkansas law actually was amended. And once that law was amended, the case was sealed. It was like my saving grace that I never had to go back to see my mom again. The family who adopted me was actually my first foster family. And they were actually too old to adopt per the court system, but they had been foster parents for more than 30 years and had raised over 300 children in their home. And by the time my case was over, the judge knew that other families had looked into my case and explored it, but were scared away from it because of the circumstances and because of how crazy my biological family was. They didn't want to get involved, which, you know, as an adult, I can understand that. As a child, I never did. But the family who adopted me, they were 60 years older than me. So when I was adopted the month before I was six. So at 5 years old, my dad was 65 and my mom was 64. And they were wonderful people. Both of them, I think, were in a way like my saving grace. They loved me fiercely. They always supported me growing up. And the one thing that I think I'm the most thankful for about my parents is they always told me the truth. No matter the circumstance, no matter the detail, no matter how in-depth the question was I asked about my childhood or my real family, they always told me the truth. And sometimes that was a really hard truth, but they were very strong in their faith. My dad was a missionary Baptist preacher for at the end of his preaching career. He'd been preaching for almost 55 years. So very strong Christian man, good morals and family values. And I would say that I had a good childhood growing up. Once I was adopted, once I was out of, Ashley's reign, I still had regular contact with Ashley. Unfortunately, she knew my parents' landline phone that they had for years. I still have that phone number memorized. It's been gone for more than 10 years now. But every birthday, every major holiday, she would call, and it was always the same thing. It was always my fault. It was my fault that I was taken away. It was my fault that she got in trouble. I was deserving. I deserved all of the abuse because I didn't listen or I wouldn't do things right. My parents would try to shield me from that, but at the same time, they didn't want to just completely take me away from Ashley. At 8 years old, we moved to a farm in the middle of nowhere, and my parents raised me like they raised their kids in the 50s. And looking back as a child, I hated it because of the responsibility of the farm and the farm animals. But now being a parent, I've actually told Hannah if we could ever go buy that exact same piece of property, I'd do it tomorrow and our kids would learn how to milk cows.
Oh.
So she'd be a Hannah would be a rancher.
I'm not opposed to it.
Yeah. So I used to have the same nightmare over the situation that, you know, I was able to be removed from. Just to, I guess, make it real, I guess the situation that that happened that led to me being taken away from Ashley and her rights being terminated. My biological mom and her boyfriend attempted to circumcise me with a razor blade. I don't know why. I don't know. You know, that's something that wasn't performed on me when I was a baby because I was born in distress and immediately placed into the NICU and then foster care. But I guess just to set the gravity of the situation, I used to have a nightmare, the same nightmare every night over that situation. The sights, the sounds, the smells, the pain. And I'd have night terrors. I was placed in therapeutic counseling when I was really, really young is a stipulation of my adoption. And I was actually clinically diagnosed with PTSD at 8 years old. And medicated, and you know, it seems like all the counselors just wanted to give me medications to try to keep me calm. They never really tried to address the issue. And I think what always made me the most mad is when a counselor would look at you and say, you know, I understand. It's like, no, you have no clue. So I say all that to say, when I turned 14, I started, you know, a lot of those PTSD flashbacks and nightmares started manifesting, and I started developing really, really poor coping skills, which began with alcohol and marijuana. And, you know, just like all of the hundreds of stories that we hear of addiction, that's how it usually starts, and then it snowballed very quickly. By 16, I had attempted suicide. It was July 31st, 2009. My mom and my best friend actually found me hanging in our barn, where I had made my first attempt. And I spent 14 days in my first mental health facility over that attempt. I came back to school, and I was in high school, so everyone thought I was crazy, and it snowballed. By 16, I had my first DWI, was placed on probation, and it just got worse. I couldn't use recreational drugs, marijuana, pills, alcohol. And it was during that time that K2 made its debut into the United States, and it was not illegal. And we have, you know, we used to have a store in town that sold it, and that became my drug of choice. And I was using large amounts of K2, not knowing what it was, not knowing what it was doing to my body. But I was also on drug court where I couldn't, you know, I was being drug tested multiple times a week. That was the only thing I could do to avoid the tests. And then I finally was arrested in my senior year at school for possession of K2. And I spent 35 days in jail and 52 days in my first conventional rehab. So by the time I was 18, I had attempted suicide a total of four times. I'd overdosed multiple times. And on May the 13th of 2013, I was 18 years old. I walked into Team Challenge on my first day, which was a faith-based program for drug and alcohol dependency, where I was court ordered to go. And Team Challenge was my 14th facility since the age of 14. And I guess I have to back up just a little bit. I met biological siblings when I was 13 on my dad's side. They were all adults. You know, just like any kid that grows up in the system, when you find out you have siblings, it's like you're excited. It's the best thing in the world. You know, I remember thinking, like, I have people. Not to take away from my adopted family, but like, I have people. Like, they're my real siblings. And I met all four of them and thought they were all Superman and Superwoman. And I actually, it's a crazy story how I met my brother. He was a youth pastor that my dad had brought in to preach one night. And my after the service, my parents brought me to the front of the church. And my mom asked me, you know, do you know your dad's name? And I was like, yeah, his name is Merwin. He's sitting right here. And he's, you know, they said, no, your real dad's name. And I said, no, I'd actually never known my real dad's name. And they said his name. Well, my brother was a junior. So when they said his name, I was like, all right, cool. And then he was like, that's my name. And so I thought for a second that he was my dad. And he said, no, I'm your brother. Crazy. You know, that doesn't happen any other way other than, you know, God aligning that. We got very close. My parents trusted him because he was, you know, he's a preacher. What they didn't know is he had a drug history, just like all of my other siblings. He ended up relapsing. And one of the nights, I guess the big night that he relapsed, I was actually staying at his house with him and his wife. And he started beating his wife, and I tried to stop it. He turned on me, and, you know, a 30-year-old man versus a 13-year-old kid, it didn't work out well in my favor. But they moved away. All of my siblings moved back to California. I didn't get to see him again, so it was like I got all my hopes up. All these siblings are so cool. And then boom, they're gone again. And my brother, it was really bad what he did. I moved in with a biological sister when I was 18. And it was that sibling who introduced me to my drug of choice, which was crystal meth. And that was one of the darkest times of my life because of how quickly it went off the cliff. But when I went into Teen Challenge, I was 18 years old, 6'1" and 130 pounds, just a skeleton. I didn't want, full transparency, I didn't want to go to the program. I had been charged with a second DWI, and the judge over my case was also the judge on my case the first time. So he had watched me progress through juvenile drug court, and he couldn't do anything because the juvenile court had jurisdiction. Now I was an adult. Now he had the say, so he court ordered me, and I went in bucking and screaming and fighting. But about 7 months into the program, I finally submitted and, you know, realized that this was probably my last shot. I had known Christ my whole life. Actually, May the 5th of 2002, I was 8 years old. I can remember asking God to save me. And that's the night that I know that I asked God to save me and that I was saved because it was my dad's birthday. I'll never forget. But I don't know that I ever had a real relationship. When I got out of Teen Challenge, I graduated July of 2014. I met Hannah the next month. And I think one of the things that was so unique about Hannah, when we met, she said, "Tell me who you are." We met at a bonfire. Like I said, we live in a small town. There's not much to do around here. But we just burn things, I guess. And everyone kind of hangs out. But that night, she said, "Tell me who you are." And I told her the whole story, the good, the bad, and the ugly. And I finished the story and she says, "Okay, cool. I mean, I hate that you went through that, but who are you?" And I was like, "I just told you." And she said, "No, you didn't tell me who you are. You told me what you've been through." And she was like, "So who are you?" And it hit me that I didn't know who I was. I didn't know who I was outside of the trauma. I didn't know who I was outside of the drug addiction. And it caught me off guard. I was like, well, okay, then let me just reevaluate some things. When I realized that Hannah and I were going to get serious and actually date, I told her, you know, I need to sit down and talk to your parents. It's a small town. They're going to find out. They're going to know who I am. And Hannah thought that was a terrible idea.
Yeah, I was like, we can just skip that part, actually.
Yeah. Her dad is a 20-year Air Force vet and just a stellar guy, you know, but a man's man. You know, I knew that he would be protective over his daughter. So we compromised, and I talked to her parents.
He loves that joke.
I do.
He loves it.
It's true. But I remember that night I came into their house and, you know, I just kind of opened it up, and not arrogantly, I don't think, but I told Rob after it was all said and done, if that's not what you want your daughter surrounded by, I'm okay with shaking hands, cutting ties, and I'll honor that, and I'll walk away, and I'll never talk to, never talk to her again. We lived three houses away from each other. We didn't know that. It's one of the things that we found out. But Rob looked up from, he had a laptop in his lap, and he's watching some sports game on the TV, and he had his glasses down on his nose, and he said, okay, all that I'm going to ask is if you go back, you leave my daughter here. And the rest is a wrap.
Yeah.
I think both of us were children, or very immature young adults who had no clue what life was. I had one dream and one dream only, and that was to have a family of my own. God is good. I have that now, but you know, I don't think it came easy. I think that Hannah and I both worked really, really hard. We each lived away from each other with our parents, you know, the first couple of years of our relationship. I worked at Best Buy right out of Teen Challenge. It was the first job that I could get. Hannah worked at PetSmart. She's an animal lover. She's basically a cross between Steve Irwin and Snow White.
My pet spiders are behind us, actually.
Yeah. Yeah, she has pet spiders back here.
I do.
But I heard about a welding college. We heard about it. Bonfire. And 9 days later, I loaded all of my belongings into a truck and moved 2.5 hours away. And up to that point in our relationship, we'd never been away from each other more than a couple of days, just because we lived so close to each other. We became best friends, but we were also boyfriend and girlfriend. So it was like the first real test, I think, of our relationship. Now, don't get me wrong. I was 21. 22. I was 22.
Yeah, so I was.
You were 20.
We're 2.5 years apart, so it falls about 2 and 3 years, depending on when our birthdays are. I was 17 and he was 20 when we met, and that was when we started dating. So.
Yeah. She was actually still in high school.
Yeah.
She turned 18.
The month after. Bet, I think.
Yeah, she was mad at me because I wouldn't date her at first.
I was 18. Yeah. Like, come on, I'm so close.
I don't know. But that was like the first big test of our relationship. And I was gone. If you went to the program and did 5-hour days, it was an 8-month program. If you went to the program and did 10-hour days, you could do it in 4 months. So I obviously elected to do the 10-hour days. I had nothing else better to do. And there were, you know, some weeks where I didn't get to come home. I had to work. I was working at a little gas station until midnight and waking up and going back 6 o'clock the next morning and doing it all over again. But I knew that I had to do something better for the thought of a family. And so I got certified as a welder. I had big dreams to go work on the road. You can't have a family on the road. So I tried one job. I got burnt by a friend, found out that Hannah and I were not going to be able to do that with our relationship. And I knew that my relationship with her was more important than money. So I moved back home and got a job locally and just did that for a couple of years. And then one day her dad called me, and her dad and I became best friends. There are a lot of our relationship where I never thought of him as my father-in-law. I just thought of him as a friend. He called me one day and he said, hey, I'm talking to you as your father-in-law, not your friend. I expect for you to be at the new hire seminar for the fire department. And I was like, Rob, I don't want to do that. I'm welding. I'm making decent money. And he's like, yeah, that's great, but you don't have a retirement. And my dream, I guess an aspiration rather, that I had in high school was to be a paramedic, because I felt like I always wanted to help people. Even when I was in addiction, I knew that I wanted to help people. But because of the choices that I made, you know, in my senior year in high school, that wasn't available to me at the time. So I tried everything that I could to put him off. And he was like, listen, I'll drag you do the new hire, like a seminar if I have to. And I was like, okay, fine, I'll go. So I went, and I went with a chip on my shoulder because I didn't really want to be there. And then I heard that they would put you through paramedic school. And all of a sudden the chip was gone. And I was like, yep, that sounds great. This welding shop that I'm in the summer at, you know, 120 degrees in the shop and 10 degrees in the winter is not fun. So, I started the process of like training physically to try to make sure that I could pass the physical. And in full honesty, I didn't want to go fail a test and be embarrassed in front of all the firemen, you know. Hannah and I smoked cigarettes for almost 10 years. When I got the job at the fire department, I was a 2-pack-a-day smoker. And so our run was really intense, but I practiced, I got it down. And by the grace of God, I was hired. I went through the fire academy, earned top of my class. But about my hiring, when I went into my interview, I kind of caught them off guard because I didn't want to hide anything. I know I'm familiar with background checks. I know that I'm blessed to have never had any felony charges, but I had petty misdemeanor charges that still show up on a background check. So when I came into my interview, I said, hey, I know that this is going to sound kind of crazy and people probably don't do this, but, and then I just laid it all out. And I said, listen, I'm not proud of it, but I know that there are disqualifiers for this job. And if I meet any of these disqualifiers, I don't want to waste any more of your time. You know, we can kind of shake hands and I can move on with it. But at that time I had 5 years sober and we had bought a house. We were married. We were planting roots. And I guess Chief prayed about it. And he called all my references. My references were the judge, the undersheriff of our county, the mayor at the time, who was part of one of my probation cases. So my references, thank God, said give him a chance. So like I said, I went to the fire academy, got top of my class. I had an opportunity to go to EMT school, got top of my class. And then paramedic school rolled around. I was able to complete it in the middle of COVID. I got top of my class in paramedic. And it was during paramedic school that Hannah and I found out that she was pregnant with our oldest son, Nathan. And it was also during that time she worked for a law enforcement agency at a detention center where something happened and we both mutually said, hey, we don't think this is the most safe career for you to be in pregnant. And I don't know how many times we ran the numbers on our budget.
Yeah, we ran them several times.
And every single time on paper, I was like, we can't, you're going to have to work. I'm sorry. No matter what it is. But God is good and God is faithful. And I was able to pick up shifts as an EMT at the EMS agency in town. Now it was detrimental on my part toward Hannah because I wasn't emotionally available to Hannah like when she was pregnant, like she needed. I was working at 24/48 at the fire department. And when I'd get off of work at the fire department, I'd go to the ambulance. I worked 12-hour shifts. And if I wasn't on the fire engine or the ambulance, I was in paramedic school. And if I wasn't in paramedic school, I was in the emergency department doing clinicals or in the operating room doing clinicals or on an ambulance doing clinicals. So, and it was COVID. So we were truly like, I'm like original COVID where you couldn't leave your house, only essential employees. So Hannah was here by herself and I was gone, coming in every day, dressing down in the garage, you know, because we didn't know what we were bringing in. And, you know, I was like the most careful person at the department. And I still was the first person to contract COVID at my fire department. Not only was I the first person to get it at the fire department, 3 days or 4 days after I tested positive, Hannah gave birth to Nathan.
Yeah.
So I was not able to be present for Nathan's birth, but the doctor was really understanding and allowed us to FaceTime. And, you know, although her mom was kind of like this, I still got to experience his birth and see him come out healthy and see Hannah healthy.
I wasn't due until the end of October, but the stress of the COVID situation, and I didn't know that I had preeclampsia, but I guess that was a blessing in disguise because then we caught that. But my blood pressure was through the roof and they were like, we need to induce you tonight. I was like, my husband can't come for 14 days. And I had to wear like a mask while I was in labor and everything. It was horrible, but
the day that I came home from work when I tested positive was horrible. It was like we were divorcing or something.
It was like a breakup. Yeah, I was like getting all the stuff for the baby, and he was like standing 20 feet away.
Our first family photo is actually me looking through a sliding glass door like this. As she's pulling that up, we'll just I guess the rest is pretty routine, you know. Here it is. So creepy.
That's our first family photo.
So for the next 4 years I worked for the fire department and the ambulance agency, and then I got another job at the emergency department in our area. And I worked a lot. I mean, I was gone a whole lot, but at that time we had to financially. And it was hard. You know, Hannah was raising Nathan, not necessarily by herself because I was still around, but there were so many days I was just gone. And then by the time I'd get home, you know, I was either ready to go to bed or Nathan was already asleep. And then I had my first back surgery in May of 22, which slowed things down a little bit. I had like 3 months home, which was awesome. It was terrible because I'd had surgery, but it was awesome being able to slow down. When I was released to go back to work, it was the same thing. Full throttle, as many hours as I could work. I had my second back surgery 15 months after my first. It was also during this time Hannah and I were kind of discussing having a second child. Hannah struggled with postpartum depression and anxiety pretty badly after Nathan, which I don't think is talked about enough. You know, ladies, y'all got it going on, and then having to deal with all the hormones, and I can't imagine. We talked about another kid, and we actually started making moves toward another kid, and I noticed pretty quickly that wasn't going to be the move, and I wasn't willing to lose Hannah over the possibility of another child. So we stopped that, and one day Hannah said, "How do you feel about adopting?" And I was like, "Nope. If you mean dealing with DHS or DCFS, nope. I want nothing to do with it." And it was because of...
So we compromised,
and we became foster parents. That joke sure did turn around on me.
Yeah, she got you back.
Our pastor, I had already had fostering on my heart because my cousin adopted 4 children out of the system. And our pastor had preached a sermon. You know how the pastor always preaches exactly what you don't want to hear, you know, but you need to hear, about the orphan and the widow. And a couple of foster families in our church shared their stories. And I was like, I think we need to foster. And obviously foster care is not you shouldn't go into it expecting to adopt, but we signed up as a foster and adopt home so that we could foster until there was a child that needed to be adopted. And then we would go into that. And then it just turned out that our very first placement was our son, Austin. We got him. I actually started visiting him at 1 day old in the NICU, and we've had him since he was 1 day old. Yeah. No family visits, nothing. He's always just been with us. And when the option came to adopt him, they were like, "Are you interested?" And we were like, "Yes, we'll adopt him yesterday."
Yeah.
He's amazing.
Yeah. Austin's entire case, and we don't have enough time in the day to explain all of the God winks and how God's hand was on his case. So, for example, his due date was...
Yeah, so my mom...
Or his birthday.
Yeah, his birthday.
Yeah.
My mom gave birth to a stillborn baby before me, and her due date was Austin's birthday. And so that was always kind of like a dreary day for our family. And then it was Valentine's Day. And so every time Valentine's Day would come around, it'd be like, okay, like this is when my sister was supposed to be born, but you know, I'm an only child technically, you know, Earth side. And so whenever we found out that he was born on Valentine's Day, my mom was like, "Hold on just a second." Like, so my mom has always had this like super attachment to him.
Another example, whenever his case changed from foster to adopt, there had to be an adoption bibliography completed for him for like possible adopted families to read. Nobody knew him other than us. I mean, he was our son. So the lady called us to interview, and we're sitting on Hannah's phone after church one day on FaceTime with this lady. And she's asking us all these questions, and she gets to the question of, do the two of you feel bonded to this child?
We were like, yeah.
So we give her, I'm going to call it the textbook answer, right? Like, yeah, of course, he's bonded with our son. He's bonded with us. We've had him since he was a baby. Of course, we feel bonded to him. We'd love the opportunity to adopt him. And I'm sitting there thinking, like, I'm not going to chase the rabbit. I'm not going to tell her that I was a foster child. And I kept feeling this nudge. I was like, you know what? I am going to tell her. And I said, also, I was raised in the system. I know what it's like to be a foster child. I know what it's like to be an adopted child. I know the struggles that I had as an adopted child. No matter how much love I was given, looking at adopted parents and thinking, why would you want me? Why didn't my family want me? And I said, whenever he becomes a teenager and starts asking those hard questions, who better to answer them than someone who's been there? And that woman,
that was so weird.
she all she said was, I knew that was you. And Hannah and I like look at each other and we're like, well, this is kind of weird. What's going on? My caseworker 30 years ago quit her job because of how bad my case was and how because the court system wouldn't listen to the caseworkers. It was her.
Oh my gosh.
The lady who did our son's adoption bibliography, she said, I was your caseworker 30 years ago. And of course, we're like, okay, no, you weren't. You know, like kind of prove it.
Prove it.
And
she started naming all Tracy's relatives' names and his address. And she's like, he was like, okay, like.
Couldn't believe it. Yeah. Absolutely couldn't believe it. And so she was like, yeah, don't worry. I'll do everything that I can to help y'all.
Yeah.
But just the way that God had his hand on Austin's case specifically was amazing. And I want to point something out too. No marriage is perfect. Not every day are we going to get along. And I'm sure there are days that y'all probably don't get along. That's just part of life. It's just part of marriage. One of the biggest arguments we've ever been in our entire marriage was during Austin's case.
Yeah.
And we actually were...
It was the day we found out that he was almost 6 months old. And we were supposed to adopt him like 3 weeks later. And we found out that an out-of-state adopted relative had come forward and said that she was interested in him.
A very distant relative.
Very distant.
Yeah.
60 years old. So it would kind of be the same. Yeah. Like Tracy knew, you know, although his parents were very loving and amazing and they very literally saved him from a horrible situation, there's still, you know, there's things that come with an age gap. Yeah. Yeah, it's hard. And that it was the day that happened.
Both of us were boiling with emotions and it manifested toward each other. You know, and it was during the argument, we were both very, very, very upset, arguing with each other. It was in the argument that we both realized, I'm not mad at you and you're not mad at me. We're both mad at the system. And it was like a fire was lit that day that we were going to fight for our son, and we hired an attorney, and the rest is history. So as a kid, when I started maturing and asking hard questions to my parents, I remember asking my adopted parents, why would you want me? Why would you want to take my case on? Why would you want to get into the weeds of all of that? And my dad told me the day that the caseworker brought me home, I cried so miserably all the way from the hospital to their home that when she dropped me off, she dropped me off and left. There was no talking, no contact. She was, you know, so I don't want to say fed up, but fed up with me crying. I was inconsolable. And my dad took me and he said within minutes, he had me soothed and calm. And he said it was in that moment he looked at me at 2 days old and I smiled at him. And he looked at my mom and he said, Thelma, this one is mine. We're going to keep this one. And of course, my mom was like, well, you know, Merlin, it doesn't really work like that, but we'll do what we can. And the second part of this story is when we started fostering our youngest son. The day that we got to bring him home, we drove to Children's Hospital.
That was the first day that you had met him.
It was the first day that I met him.
I had been visiting him, but it was still COVID, so.
Hannah handed me Austin, and And within minutes, he smiled at me. And it was in that moment, I knew my story had come full circle. You know.
Them when he very first held him.
Oh my goodness.
Tracy looked down at him and looked up at me and said, "This was me 30 years ago." And of course, I'm like bawling in the children's hospital, and everyone's looking at me like I'm crazy.
Yeah, the nurses are coming in. They're like, "What is happening?" And we're like, you don't want to get into the weeds right now.
It's a full circle moment right now.
So, so many different God winks, you know?
Yes.
So,
that's an incredible story, and it's our spirits know more than what we know. You know what I mean? Like, there was no reason for you to look up at your dad and smile at 2 months. That was, like you said, that's a God wink, and man, that is, and then for you to have that same experience, that's.
When it was crazy, I didn't have to think about it. The second he smiled, I was wrecked. Absolutely wrecked. You know, and then Hannah looked at me, and of course I was like, "Yeah, 30 years ago, this was me." And now she's wrecked. But
we're all crying, all three of us.
which don't get me wrong, we were both parents by then, so I was a dad, I was a father at that point. But the fire that I had for Austin, and I don't take anything away from our son, Nathan.
Mm-hmm.
Also, people have asked me, "Do you love him differently?" And the answer is no. You know, if we want to be technical, have I loved Nathan longer? Yes, but he's also 3.5 years older than Austin. But I love each of our boys the same. And I know the questions will come. I know the hard conversations will happen, and we have talked about it. We've already communicated about it. We plan to handle all of those hard questions the same way that my parents handled my situation. I think the best method is honesty, but I also think that there's a little bit of discernment that comes with those answers. Mm-hmm. You know, can we wait on some of those answers if he's 7 years old versus 17? Yes, I think so. If we can't, I know that God will help us navigate through those hard conversations.
Well, then we'll be texting each other because we're in the same situation. We'll help each other out.
Yeah, absolutely. I'll just share one of my favorite situations about his adoption day. I took the day off, obviously, from the fire department, and I just told the guys, "Hey, I won't be at work. We're adopting our son." That's all I told them. I didn't tell them where, I didn't tell them what time, I didn't tell them the room, I didn't tell them anything. And, you know, I mentioned earlier, the one thing that I wanted, my dream in life was to have a family. And God works in such funny ways because he blessed me with my family, Hannah and our boys and Hannah's parents, and my dad is still around. But he also blessed me with a whole bunch of brothers. And a third of my fire department showed up, and I didn't ask him to be there.
Every time another one walked in, Tracy would start crying all over again.
You'll notice this photo. This is our oldest son. I'm not even holding him. That's my partner at work. That's my partner training officer that's holding him. And I actually framed that photo in a 3-foot by 2-foot canvas. It's above my desk. Just because it shows God's plan. For me individually, for us as a family, there's no reason why I should be sitting here. I didn't think that I would survive until I was 25 or 30. I just turned the ripe old age of 32 this year. I've had 3 back surgeries, and I feel old some days, but...
You act old some days.
I don't know. God has been abundantly gracious to us.
Yeah.
You know, my biological mom had another son after me. There are, let me think about this. There's 5 years between us. We were separated. I saw him one time when I was 6 years old, when he was a baby, and I never saw him again. And in 2015, I turned 21. I went to DHS, and I was told that at 21, you could go and they would give you the records of your siblings. It's not true. They will not do that. And the worker told me that it was her recommendation that we make a poster and share it on Facebook. And that made me so overwhelmingly mad that I came to Hannah's house and I was like, you're not going to believe what they told me. And I told her, and she's like, that's a great idea. Let's do that. And I was like, that, no, we're not doing that.
I already had the poster board ready.
Yeah. Oh. And what it was is I didn't want to get my hopes up. I didn't want to get my hopes up to be crushed. And I guess this is one of those situations where we compromised.
We compromised, so I wrote out the poster board.
Yeah, and she was like, here, just hold this and act like you're remotely happy. And so we take the picture and we share it with – I send it via text message to a couple of our friends, and we have this plan like, hey, tomorrow morning at 8 o'clock, we're all going to post it at the same time and just see what happens. So at 0800, we share this photo. By 8 o'clock that night, I'm on the phone with his mom. The woman who adopted my little brother, I'm on the phone with her. And she calls me. Well, let me back up a little bit. It went viral. And for 2015, that was like a big thing. Mm-hmm. The news, two news stations from Little Rock called me. I was at Best Buy and they were like, hey, is this Mr. Gray? And I'm like, well, Mr. Gray's my dad, but my name's Tracy. Like, what's up? And they said, hey, are you at work? Yes, I'm at work. And they said, well, you need to go home because we're on the way to your house to interview you. And I'm like, I can't just go home. Well, I talked to my GM and he was like, yes, please go do it. He let me off. I interviewed with the news stations. They put it out immediately. And then sure enough, his mom called me and, you know, she hit me with the, you know, you're not going to believe this, but, and I said, yeah, you're probably right. Because I've received 100 phone calls today and it's all the same story. So what are you going to tell me different? And she started naming our mom and our uncles and situations and towns that only she would know. And sure enough, that was on a Tuesday. That Saturday, I got to meet him for the first time. And Hannah's uncle actually let my brother and his mom and his little sister stay in his condo on Lake Hamilton. And I got to spend a full week with him. And it was just such a blessing. He's such a good kid. He's a grown man now.
I'll say he's not a kid.
Yeah. He got to come up for our wedding and got to be a part of our wedding. And actually, he's about to move to Arkansas. So I've got to remain calm because I want to be a little giddy about it, the thought of having a little brother, you know, here. But there are so many situations in my life that I can think about where, you know, God put people directly in my path. And a lot of the times it was not comfortable. You know, with whether it be probation officers or judges, the judge over my case, as an adult, that man saved my life. That man is also a devout Christian. I remember asking him after I got at a teen challenge, what did you see in me? Why wouldn't you give up? I watched you send all these other people to jail. Why me? And he would just tell me, you know, I saw something on you or about you that I didn't want to give up on. And, you know, even after being at a teen challenge, I still had no clue what he was talking about. I thought he was talking out of the side of his neck. But I'm so thankful that God was nudging him to nudge me. Because I wouldn't have Hannah. I wouldn't have our sons. I wouldn't have the career where I get to go minister to other people. I called the ambulance my ministry because you're literally in a box with another person having the worst day of their life. And what you say and how you handle their emergency can change the outcome of their life, whether it be professionally, emotionally, spiritually. I don't get to work on the ambulance anymore because of my back and because of the position that I work for at the fire department now. But now I have the opportunity to build up the future of firefighters and the future of EMTs and paramedics and hopefully plant the seed of Christianity. You know, we are called to love our neighbor as ourselves. And people will say, well, what, how do you even apply that at a fire department? It's very easy. You know, be good at what you do and love people. If you're good at what you do and you take passion and pride into what you do, you're going to be a good provider. And if you're a good provider, but you're also a spiritually grounded person, people will notice it and they will ask you. I've had people ask me, why are you different? And a lot of the people, if we're being honest, they are I hate that they call them psych patients because they use drugs, but unfortunately that's what society labels them as psych patients. And they'll ask, you know, why do you care? Why are you different? And it's like, well, because I'm also in recovery. And a lot of the time they don't believe me because I don't look like I'm, you know, in recovery. And then you start naming facilities and staff members at facilities and the light bulb goes off and then you have a connection. And then it's like, hey, listen, I was in the same miry muck pit that you were in also. And I was mad and I was angry at God for everything that I'd been through. But then one day I realized that the things that were hurting me were also hurting God. And I realized that God never walked away from me. I walked away. And when I realized that God was in the muck and mire with me, all I had to do was turn around and say, help. My whole life changed. And that's a message that I feel like there are so many people, not even, you know, at that level, people that are just succeeding in life that have trauma so buried that they think they're past it and they can move on with their life. I feel like if they could just grasp that concept, you know, their life would change dynamically. So I guess we'd not be doing it justice if we didn't talk about Paula.
Yeah.
So in our conversation, Brent, you asked about thinking about certain angels in our life. I could highlight my adopted parents. You know, they were married for, it would have been 72 years when my mom passed. We lost my mom in September of 23 to a stroke. But I was able to share a really sweet moment with her. I was the last person she talked to before she passed, and I was able to give her a hug and tell her that I loved her, and she was still coherent. She told me that she loved me, and I, you know, we never get the chance to tell our parents that we're thankful for them, you know, as much as we should. And I told my mom that I was thankful for her. And the last thing that she said to anybody, my parents weren't physical either, but my mom reached up and grabbed my cheek and she told me that she thanked God for me. And that was the last thing that she ever said to anybody. And she died that next morning. But I could go on and on and on about my parents, about being my angels, but I want to highlight a woman who was my caseworker, who fought for me, who fought tooth and nail for me. We actually learned recently that she had developed a relationship with Ashley and tried to help Ashley and realized that, you know, she was kind of beyond it. Her name's Paula. She was my caseworker and not the caseworker who did the adoption bibliography. I did not remember that woman, but I vividly remembered Paula. I remembered her voice. When we started our social media journey, number one, we were able to find where my brother, Michael, my older brother, was buried. We found out that he didn't have a headstone. We were able to purchase him a headstone because of a GoFundMe, and we were able to place a headstone for him. But number two, we had people across the internet do this hard search for this caseworker. And then it turns out Hannah jumped on one of the leads and Hannah found her. And she still lives about 30 minutes from here. Tell them how that all went down.
I showed up at her husband's place of work with a note like, this is all of our contact information. I'm not crazy. This is who I am. This is who my husband is. And he gave her the note card and she got back to us a few days later.
She waited a little while.
Yeah.
You know, and she said she thought about it. And then she said, if this is really Tracy, you know, that's actually the only reason she felt comfortable because of my adopted parents. We got in contact and I fell apart. I was actually on the training grounds at the fire department. We were in the middle of a large scale training event when she called and I took it and just was in shambles. And then we were able to meet and have dinner together. And I told Hannah, do you remember the one thing I told you she used to always say to me?
Something, baby.
Yep.
Yeah.
Whenever I was, you know, hurting the most, or when she'd pick me up, she would always say, hey, baby.
Yeah.
And,
you're kind of a picture of
her. Yeah.
Yeah.
Within minutes, I mean, literal minutes of seeing, not even minutes, like seconds of running into her. There's, well, that's not, I want to find a photo of us together.
Yeah. I have like 50,000 photos on my phone, so I'm going to help.
Yeah, I get it.
It's bad.
There it is.
There it is.
Oh. Bless her heart.
So.
And that's the first thing she said was, hey, baby.
Yep.
Whenever we met up. And I was like, now I see why that voice was so calming, because she just has a way about her. I don't know how to explain it. Very sweet lady.
She was there on the bad day. I'll try not to get emotional. It was that day that she picked me up. She brought me back to my parents' house. And she said that she'd never take me back to see her. And I don't know why, but I believed her. And it was, you know, just a couple days later that state police showed up and, you know, God fell on that situation. And Miss Paula was somebody who, you know, I like to think of like biblical reference. She was my Gabriel. She was the angel that fell down and was willing to go to battle for me. You know, a kid that had nothing, no family. She had everything to lose for my case, and she still fought for it. And so for me to be able to reunite with Paula and just to say thank you, was huge for me. And the benefit too was I felt like a I don't know, a proud dad, because I was like, this is my wife, these are our sons.
Yeah,
like we're doing good. You know, kind of like I made it kind of deal. She asked me about Ashley, which I guess I didn't mention. Both of my biological parents, I met my dad when he got out of prison when I was 17. That's a long story. It ended very poorly. You know, he got me, that's a whole nother deal. It ended really, really poorly. But my biological mom and my biological dad died within 9 months of each other. Ashley was 44 when she passed, if that tells you how hard she lived. And my dad was in his mid-50s. So it was crazy to be able to sit down with Paula, and she had all these questions. But then she, you know, she told me she knew that there was something worth fighting for. And that woman, along with so many other people in my life, were my saving grace. And it would be wrong for me also not to credit, and Hannah hates this, but like I mentioned earlier, had I not met Hannah, I know that I would not have walked down that straight path. Hannah has been my foundation and my rock since we've met. She was there for me when my mom died, which was incredibly hard. Not Ashley, but my adopted mom. I actually remember coming inside the house and I gave her a hug and I said, I don't know how to let you help me, but I need your help. I can't do this alone. And she just hugged me and just kind of held me. And I wouldn't be even close to half of the man that I am today, or husband or father, had it not been for Hannah and all of her support. So she hates credit. She hates the attention. But you're deserving of it. And I know that probably one of the biggest angels in my life is I'm fortunate enough to call my wife. So
as one of the first things that I wanted to say is just hearing your guys' story and hearing that Hannah like wanted more from you, you know, who are you? And I could see that was the driving force to your change. And so, Hannah, honestly, I don't know you, but I love you. And you such an inspiration. And you can just tell, like, you have a light about you. And you're so humble. And, yeah.
I was going to say, at 17, to ask that question, that's a deep question.
Yes. And it caught me off guard.
I was just going to say, it caught you off guard. But I also wanted to say, Tracy, and you're not going to want to take the credit for this either, but you are like an inspiration from what you have been through and come from. I mean, there's people in life that just come into this world in a terrible situation. And it was that way for you. And I know that you're not going to say that anything, you're not where you are because of anything that you've done. And that's partially true. And you talked about God's plan, like that you are living God's plan. And I hear that all the time from people. And it wasn't necessarily his plan for you to be born in the situation that you were, but he takes those terrible things. There's nobody better at taking just the absolute hell and turning it into perfection. He does that. He doesn't force us to choose his plan, right? And that's where I want to give you the credit, is he put people in your life. He made things happen for you. He was there the whole time, like you said, but you had to choose his plan. And you did that. And
like I said before, I also chose, though, many years to buck the plan and to push the plan away. But I'm so thankful that there were stronger minded people who had legal authority to say, nope, you're not running anymore. You know, I think a lot of us, I don't think most people enjoy credit or spotlight. Number one, thank you, Brent, for the kind words. But I do want to highlight that I ran for a long time. I tried desperately to take, you know, the life that God gave me. I tried to take it from God, and I even tried to take it from myself. And I'm so fortunate. I'm so blessed that I never developed a TBI. I never developed, you know, a hypoxic brain injury from the overdoses. I would say that I'm thankful that I'm normal, but
he's not normal.
I was going to say someone might disagree. But I'm thankful that, I'm able to share, you know, and if I'm being honest, I've been in this weird season where it feels like, I felt like my testimony has not been, like, I've gone through this weird season where I feel like it's not worth sharing. And I don't really know why. I think that's just like the enemy knocking on my doorstep. But again, thank you so much for just, you know, letting us hang out and kind of share.
Tracy, seriously, I'm going to beg you to share, continuing to share, because people need to hear it. And that's the whole point of our podcast, is so that people do not feel alone in their grief and the things that they have gone through. And hearing your story, I mean, I could continue to listen to your guys' story for hours. And it's truly, like, I hate to say it, but it's one of my favorites. You know, there's so many pieces of miracles in your story, and it reminds us of our story. I don't know if you know anything about our story, but
with our son.
Yeah. And just the miracles, and you're giving hope to other couples, other people, other children. And keep sharing, please.
I just want to echo, we're so thankful that we get to come on y'all's platform. And, you know, we don't know what's next for us. I mean, I think I had to answer a question yesterday for a questionnaire, like, that said, what do you think God's will for your life is? I said, I have no clue. Not a clue. I've quit trying to figure it out. I went to a men's retreat a year ago. Mm-hmm. Now, Hannah actually got to go to the women's retreat, the same program this year. And my prayer was, you know, God, what do you want from me? I don't know. What do you want me to do in our church, in our community? And the only thing that that rested with me was one word. And I didn't audibly hear God's voice, but the one word that rested on my spirit was the word lead. And I said, okay, well, I'm not a leader, but where? And I didn't get an answer. So I don't know what God's will for my life is or for our lives. I do know that right now I'm finding a lot of peace in learning how to be a good husband, learning how to be a good father, and really trying to enjoy, you know, the sweet time that we have with our boys.
I think you got part of an answer with lead with our marriage.
Yeah, so within. We do lead a, we're leaders in a ministry called Reengage, which is actually a curriculum that's available nationwide. And we may be young in age compared to some of our couples. You know, there's a lot of details of our marriage that, we learn how to, you know, fight for each other. And then Austin's case in itself was, such a strain, you know, but we learned to, you know, sit at Jesus's feet and learn how to communicate and give it to him. So we do get to lead at our church, and I'm glad you said that. I certainly don't want to take away from that. I get to serve on our worship team. I don't play the guitar. I beat around on a guitar, and they let me stand up there and act like I know what I'm doing. And I'll tell you one of the really sweet things that we've started doing. So I told you that my dad was a preacher, and my mom was a piano player. And so I grew up in a family of kind of country, bluegrass, gospel music. When I was a kid, we used to have all of our church members to our house on the farm on a Friday night, and we would just play music all night long. My mom would play the piano. My brother and I played the guitar. There was a banjo in the mix sometimes. My dad played the harmonica. And that was always such a sweet time that we got to fellowship together. Well, Hannah and I, we call it an underground life group because it's not a real life group. We started having friends over, and we call it potluck and praise, where we'll cook food and everyone else will bring food and we'll have dinner with each other and fellowship. And we don't live in a big house. It's funny in the social media world, people think like we're rolling in money. And I tell them like, listen, I'm a firefighter. We're not rolling in money. So we don't live in a really big house, but we love it because when we get in our living room, we're this close and everybody's just singing their hearts out. So I guess I have gotten an answer, or God has opened the doors for areas for me to lead in. I'm really proud of the way that Hannah and I are able to subtly and sometimes just out in the open minister on our social medias. I mean, you know, even when we do things like this, you know, I have a shirt that says Jesus Saves. And every time that I get a chance, I put it in a video because I feel like the whole world needs to see it. And a lot of the videos, again, I'm not ignorant to my story. I know that it is a little bit of a tearjerker and can be hard to hear sometimes. So when we share videos, I know that some people are going to have a guttural reaction to it, and it's going to make them feel a certain type of way. And I know that people ask, how's he alive? How's he normal? How does he, you know, how is their family having so much fun in their videos? How is their life so positive? And it's like, I want that to be the background. I want people to know that without Jesus at the center of it, we wouldn't be here. I would be in the ground. I promise you. There would not be joy. There wouldn't be laughter. We wouldn't have our children. So where do we go from here? I have no clue, but we're going to keep loving each other and loving our kids. And I think there's another opportunity for me to share on another show about my story. We're just going to share as much as we can and hopefully build some awareness for foster care because the system's broken. Mm-hmm. And what we've learned also is that it's not just broken in the United States. It's worldwide. Yeah. We've had...
Tracy keeps a list of all the countries and people that we know now.
Yeah.
The big list. I mean,
all the way from Australia to Scotland to United Kingdom, Romania. There was a South American country, maybe Argentina. But the whole world, the system focuses and pushes reunification so hard that they forget about the safety and security of the children. And it baffles me. And I don't know. We might have opportunities to speak locally. Actually, when we went through our foster care training, I got into an argument with a lady that was supposed to be training us.
We almost didn't get licensed. You got so mad about the training.
So she said something to the effect of, when these children come in your home, you have to give them physical affection. And I was like, no. And then, but she was kind of like, they're not going to want to be physically affectionate, but the best thing that you can do is hug them. And I'm thinking like, no, it's not. So I'm kind of wrestling with like raising my hand.
And I'm
hands.
Like, no.
Yeah. So finally I raised my other hand. And she's like, oh, Mr. Gray, what, do you have something? And I was like, yeah, I just respectfully, I think that you're wholeheartedly, I don't think that you could be more wrong. And she was like, oh, well, then tell me why you feel so strongly about that. And I was like, well, I was one of those kids that came from a horrible situation where there was physical and sexual abuse. And you got to remember, these kids that are coming into your home, you might love them. They don't know you. And they just came from horrible situations where they're not going to trust you. If they don't trust their own parents, you think they're going to trust you? And I said, the best thing that you can do is provide them, you know, the blanket of security. You're safe here. Here, you know, are your resources. Here's your food, your water, your drinks, your whatever, your candies, your cookies. Here's your bathroom. This is your bedroom. You're safe here. Let them come to you. And she couldn't wrap her like mind around it. We got into a little bit of a discussion, and the next day that we came back, she pulled me to the side and she apologized, and she said, it makes sense why my husband had so much more success with the kids than I did, because the husband would do just that. He would say, hey, you don't know us, we don't know you, believe it or not, we love you, you're safe here, we'll let you know when it's dinner time, lunchtime, this is your bathroom, you use it whenever you'd like, there are snacks in the fridge in this drawer, you don't have to ask us. If you're hungry and it's not dinner time, you just come get these. And I guess it was a good learning moment, because she didn't know. She came from, you know, nothing against her, but she came from a really, really good background.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe we can have opportunities in the future to speak even locally to like CASA and foster cares here. I don't know.
Yeah, there have been a couple people email us asking for Tracy to speak at different events for foster and stuff like that. So hopefully, if it lines up with his schedule, hopefully he can
do
that.
I'm not really sure if these people really want an Arkansan with a weird mustache coming and talking to everybody.
They do. Our message is our message, and you have a message to share.
That's
so
weird. Did you hear that? That's really good.
Yeah, you need to write a book or be on a movie or do a movie or something.
Oh,
I can already see it.
He's like 2 pages into a book, but he won't get past that second page.
I'm like, I've got like 12,000 words on a Word document.
Well, we know some authors, so if you need help.
I definitely need help. Someone told me I needed a ghostwriter, and I don't know how any of that works. The handicap sometimes of living in a bubble that's this big is we don't know logistics. I had someone tell me yesterday to use AI to write the book. And I was like, I don't think that I'm going to use AI to write my books. I'll probably just keep sharpening my crayons and trying to remember how to spell certain words. But
the book will be coming eventually.
Yeah. Good. Good.
Chrissy was writing that book.
Yeah. And truth be told, we're open and welcoming to any logistical help or just advice. It's a little daunting, I guess, to think about. When I shared my story the first time on the We're All Insane, I was terrified. And it's not because, you know, I had shared my story before, but not to the entire world.
Mm-hmm.
And not in vivid detail. And you know, I think about writing a book, which would be even in more detail. And what I have written, it got way, way more in depth. And it's scary, you know, because people are cruel. And the other side of that is the devil is not just cruel. He's the best at what he does. He's not good at it. He's the best at what he does. And I think like the seed of insecurity was planted forever ago for me. And it's not an excuse, but I lean on it sometimes. Like, no, I don't need to write this book. I'll make excuses like I've got to do work, or I've got other things that I need to focus my time on. But one day, Hannah's got two aunts that have their master's plus 30 in English, and they're like, hey, we'll help you.
And a grandma who has a...
And a grandma, okay. So... Family of English teachers.
Family of English
teachers. Well, you connect with the right people, and, you know, that's where it comes from, you know? Knowing good people that want to help you and support you. So we're thrilled that you guys came. We're so thankful. Did you want to say anything? Usually Brent has a lot more words, so you left him speechless.
I've just loved listening to you. It's been awesome. I'm so thankful for the angels in your life, for helping you get to where you are. And Hannah, I'm sure that he's an angel for you and has helped you get to where you
absolutely
are.
Absolutely. Yes. Well.
Sometimes I feel like the devil on the shoulder, you know.
Hey, we have to be sometimes, you know.
Yeah.
I'm very grateful for our life together. I mean, I would not trade it for a winning lottery ticket. So we're very blessed.
You're a power couple.
So Hannah and Tracy, our final question that we ask all of our guests is we ask them to share one thing that they know to be true. We'd love for you both to share with our guests one thing that you know to be true.
You want to go first? You want to go first? Okay. Mine would just be to anyone listening, there's nothing that you've done. There's no place that you've gone that makes Jesus not love you. You're not too far gone, and he's there waiting for you to come home. So that's mine.
I want to compliment what Hannah said, and then I'll give you mine. Your sin can never outrun God's grace. It doesn't matter how big it is. It can't outrun God's grace. And God is a real living God. He's just waiting on us. I think that was my primary answer. And then the one thing that I like to point out, it's okay not to be okay. It's okay to look back on your trauma. You just can't stay there. If you don't deal with your trauma, someday your trauma will deal with you, whether you want it to or not. And it even says in the word that the things that we have in the darkness, it can be used against us. Satan can use that and bind us and lock us down. And it hurts to look back at some of those things, because we go through a lot of terrible things, all of us. The one thing that each person on the face of this planet can relate with is trauma, somewhere or sometime in their life. Although it hurts to look at it, you have to pull it out, because when you remove that darkness and put it into the light, Satan has no reign over you. And that darkness, the price has already been paid by Jesus' blood. So although we may be ashamed of it and we may be sad or resentful or hurt, it's already been paid for. We just have to do like what Hannah said. We just have to come home. So that'd probably be my second.
Love it.
That's great. Love it.
That was perfect. Yep. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely.
Both shining your lights so bright, and I love it. I'm so grateful that you shared it with us and our listeners today.
Absolutely. We're very thankful just to be a part of your show.
We'll let everybody get out of here. Go look for those angels.
Thanks for joining us on Angels Among Us. You can find us on YouTube and wherever you listen to podcasts. Follow along for more stories of everyday miracles and reminders that angels are among us. If you have a story to share, please email or DM us with a brief summary. We'd love to hear from you. And remember, when we are waiting, God is working.